Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and as always, with me is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Massimo, tonight is a very special taping of the Rationally Speaking podcast. We are here in front of a live audience in New York City at the University Settlement with a fantastic guest. I am so excited to introduce Ben Goldacre. Ben is a physician and academic and award-winning science writer. He writes the famous Bad Science column for The Guardian, as well as the author of two books, Bad Science in 2008, and more recently, Bad Pharma, which just came out, a critique of the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the field of medicine, which we're going to have the pleasure of discussing with him tonight. Everyone, welcome Ben Goldacre. So, Ben, I have to tell you that reading Bad Pharma made me realize a danger of ebooks that I had not previously been aware of. So, throughout my life, I have occasionally ended up reading books which, for one reason or another, made me outraged, starting, I believe, with Matilda by Roald Dahl when I was little. And my reaction upon reading these books was always to be overcome with the strong urge to punch the book. Many times throughout the course of reading the ebook version of Bad Pharma, I nearly punched a hole in my own computer. And so for our audience here and our listeners at home, maybe you could kick things off by explaining why I was so outraged while reading Bad Pharma. What is so bad about pharma?
Well, I guess to be clear, this isn't, it's not like a conspiracy theory book. I don't think that evil drug companies are poisoning us with things that'll kill you, and I don't have any vitamin pills to sell.
At least not on purpose.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Really, the title of this book should have been The Information Architecture of Evidence-Based Medicine has several interesting flaws, many of which are exploited by industry, but all of which are amenable to very low-cost fixes if anybody had the wit or the desire to crack on with it.
It's a long title.
Yeah. Well, publishers are very reluctant to have sort of over-inclusive titles like that, so we had to settle for Bad Pharma. I'm glad that it made you angry because the real struggle with all of this stuff is that people feel very abstracted away from the real world of flesh and blood and suffering and death when they're dealing with the abstractions of evidence and forest plots and effect sizes and confidence intervals. And I think that's part of the story. I think my profession have acquiesced in the face of some appalling problems, really because we've managed to convince ourselves that they're not relevant or important. So, very basically, there are kind of three chunks to the book. Firstly, trials which we like to imagine are always fair tests, can be flawed by design in such a way that they exaggerate the benefits of treatments. Next, that we endure biased dissemination of the results of clinical trials to decision makers. But the biggest and most important problem by a very long way is the problem of missing clinical trial data. So the best currently available evidence on this question comes from a systematic review. And a systematic review is immune to cherry picking. So it's amazing to think actually that in the 1980s even, if you wanted to write a chapter for a medical textbook or a review article about a particular sort of problem in medicine or you know, the treatment of depression in patients who were in hospital and also had physical illness, you would just kind of think of a few trials that you'd seen recently that you remembered. You might ask a few friends if they had any trials. You'd flick through the journals that you happen to subscribe to. Maybe you'd keep your ear out at conferences. And you get this very unsystematic collection of data that was vulnerable to all of the biases that that you educate people about. So conscious and unconscious. People would cherry pick. People would be swayed by their own subjective prejudices and so on. And then in the 1980s, we invented something called a systematic review. You describe the databases that you go to, you describe the search terms you type in, and you make sure that you get all of the evidence on one question. So I'm telling you this so that you understand that there's nothing mischievous or weird when I say that the best currently available evidence from a systematic review in 2010 shows that overall, for the treatments that we use today in medicine, the best estimate is that around half of the trials from that era have not gone on to be published, and that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results. So this is no small potatoes, right? We cannot make informed choices as doctors and patients when half of the evidence is missing. And we've known about this for three decades. We've failed to fix it. And I think, you know, people do get angry about this. And I think it's a mistake, really, to get angry at the pharmaceutical industry. It's the medics and the academics and regulators and policy people who we are most entitled to have high expectations of and who have most failed us. None of these problems are hidden from public view. All I've done is take them from the technical academic literature and deliver what I hope is a reasonably clear explanation.
So you're suggesting that the culprit here is like the culprit here is like in Murder on the Orient Express. Everybody did it. We're all responsible here.
Yeah. So and also actually that's what kind of makes it more interesting, because I'm not I've never really written about fraud. I don't find fraud very interesting. It's just like you made it up. You're an asshole. Like, thanks a lot for faking your results. But that's really obviously evil and wrong. What's really interesting about this huge sort of complex interlocking ecosystem of problems in evidence-based medicine that all reinforce each other is that for the most part, the players involved probably don't regard themselves as bad people. Mm-hmm. They act to the limits of what they would think is acceptable in the kind of grey areas. And also, we see cultural blind spots. Because, you know, if you did a sort of basic school research project age 15 and you deleted half the data points from that so that the line on the little graph went exactly how you think it ought to, we would all, I think, agree that you were guilty of research misconduct, right? But for some reason, we have a cultural blind spot in medicine and in academia about people deleting whole studies with the results that they don't like from the academic record, even though we know that all of that evidence is going to be synthesized together in one place to produce a summary of the evidence on whether something works or not. And if we delete whole studies, we will distort the overall evidence base, and that will result in people making the wrong decision.
Although I still, now that you mentioned the deleting data, I still remember an International Congress of Genetics a number of years ago where I looked at a poster and it was this nice little graph. It was a straight line through data points. And then I realized that there were two data points. And the line, remarkably, did not fit. It went just below one and just above the other one. It's like, wow. At any rate, so the statistics are fascinating, and we're probably going to go back to that in a minute. But I want to hear a particular story, like the one about reboxetine, which is something that you actually use, you prescribe for patients. So what was the story? Just so they give us a flavor of how these things actually work.
Yeah, so reboxetine is an antidepressant that I myself have prescribed, and it's an antidepressant with a fairly unusual mode of action. So if somebody hasn't got better on one class of drug, then if you want to try something new, you might try something from a completely different class. I'm a fairly dorky doctor, it won't surprise you to hear. So I tried to read the literature. So I read a couple of trials which showed that reboxetine was better than a dummy placebo sugar pill, and I found a couple of trials showing that reboxetine was just as good as any other antidepressant. In 2010, an extraordinary paper was published by an organization called ICWIG, which is the German government cost effectiveness agency, and they described a battle they'd had with Pfizer, where they'd got in touch.
I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They got in touch with Pfizer and they said, look, we are the German cost effectiveness agency. We're doing a summary of all of the evidence to help health insurers in Germany decide if they're going to pay for this treatment or not. And, you know, we're aware that often not all trials get published, and we're aware that unflattering data is more likely to go missing in action. So can you please tell us all of the trials and all of the results on everything that's ever been done on reboxetine? And Pfizer said, no. At which point ICWIG said, well, that's really not good enough, and we're certainly not going to approve this, but also this is really dodgy. What's going on? Finally, Pfizer handed it over, and what we found was that there were three studies showing that reboxetine was better than a dummy placebo sugar pill. They were all published. 7 studies showing that it was no better than a dummy placebo sugar pill, and they weren't published. There were 2 studies showing that it was just as good as any other antidepressant, but data was collected in 3 times as many patients in a trial which showed that it was worse than other antidepressants, and that data wasn't published. Now, overall, when you add all of this stuff up, depending on how you add it together, reboxetine is either completely useless, in which case it only exposes people to side effects, or at best, only shavingly better than nothing, but certainly worse than other antidepressants, in which case I wouldn't have used it. You know, I did something to my patient, which overall, in my view, probably did more harm than good, either because it was a completely useless treatment or because I gave it to them instead of what would have been a useful treatment. And actually, we shouldn't shy away from recognizing that there's an opportunity cost when you give people a treatment that's not so great because you're depriving them of a better treatment. And I think patients reasonably expect that we will give them the best treatments. In fact, actually, I think that's one of the keys to how people let themselves off the hook. Because, you know, let's say there's 2 treatments in one class. One will save 8 lives out of 100. One will save 6 lives out of 100. Well, which one do you want? You know, you want the one that's going to save 8 lives out of 100. And if you can persuade doctors to use the treatment that only saves 6 lives out of 100, well, the drug company people might feel okay about that because, hey, we've done something that's like, we've got this useful treatment. It saves 6 lives out of 100. But the net impact of you convincing somebody to use an inferior treatment through withholding data, biased trial design, and aggressive marketing is we're 2 lives down out of every 100 people. Now, we shouldn't let the fact that that's a bit sort of abstract and remote and takes 40 seconds to explain, let us shy away from the reality. You know, if there were 8 people laid out on train tracks in front of a very slow-moving shunter and I saved 6 of them and then I stop and I award myself a point for saving 6 lives, while the shunter very slowly and gradually, as I congratulate myself, crushes and kills the remaining 2 people on the tracks, well, I think you would rightly regard me as a very suboptimal physician, right?
For putting it mildly, yes.
And yet, for some reason, you know, we don't seem to regard that as an issue. I think we've been very unambitious in medicine. You know, we invented the basic principles of evidence-based medicine 3 or 4 decades ago, much more recently than we feel comfortable admitting. And then we sort of swanned around imagining that we have instantiated them, that we are competently implementing evidence-based medicine, and we're very simply not. And these imperfections, they're not just real, they are very dangerous. They result in unnecessary loss of life. And it should be okay to talk about that.
Ben, the parts that... There were parts of your book that really gave me this sort of feeling of dejection and sort of, you know, existential crisis about the futility of it all. And those.
And
were
I have to point out that Julia is a pretty optimistic person.
I'm a pretty chipper gal.
You did a
true.
Pretty good job there.
In general. And those parts were the parts that you were alluding to a few minutes ago about the sort of systemic problems where, you know, individuals are all acting maybe not benevolently, all of them, but not maliciously. And the just sort of the way the systems are set up combines to produce this really, really suboptimal outcome. Sort of the same feeling I got watching The Wire, actually. Just this horrible, you know, people like failing because of institutions and the way the institutions interact with each other or don't. And
except this is much easier to fix than like social inequality.
Bold claim. I felt depressed at the parts about the systemic hurdles, and then I felt sort of frustrated and maybe annoyed at the parts in which you described how the pharmaceuticals themselves, like Pfizer, were sort of obstructing this process of us collectively trying to provide the world with the best care possible. But the parts that really riled me up were the parts where you described how entities that should have been, that I thought were in the business of improving things, like the regulatory agencies, were actually obstructing the process, maybe not as much as the pharmaceuticals, but to a much larger degree than I would have imagined possible. Can you describe that phenomenon?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's truly extraordinary, really. The people who've let us down the most are the people who we should have been able to expect are on our side. The European Medicines Agency, for example, when Cochrane, and I would hope that Cochrane is like famous to you. Cochrane is an international non-profit academic body of maybe 14,000 academics around the world who produce gold standard summaries of all the evidence for various different, you know, all, pretty much all of the relevant and interesting questions in medicine. And in about 2007, the Nordic Cochrane Collaboration were doing a systematic review on two weight loss drugs, Orlistat and Rimonabant. And they had this brainwave, right? They went, guys, you know, isn't it funny how we do these systematic reviews, but we know that half the data is missing, and we know that there's publication bias, and then what we see is the more positive results. And then they thought, well, hang on, actually, regulators have much more information than we do, right? Regulators see a lot of this stuff. They don't necessarily have absolutely all of it, but they have a lot more than we do, so why don't we ask the European Medicines Agency? So they wrote a letter to the European Medicines Agency saying, oh, hi, we're Cochrane. You might have heard of us. International non-profit, 14,000 people making these gold standard summaries that are used almost universally in medicine. Can we have all of the evidence that you've got on the risks and benefits of Orlistat and Rimonabant? And the EMA wrote back and said, no. And this triggered a 3.5 year long battle between Cochrane and the European Medicines Agency, which resulted in the single most damning finding of maladministration by the European Ombudsman that people who work in Europe say they've ever seen. You know, the findings said that the EMA, the European regulator, had failed to give an adequate or even consistent account of why they were withholding this stuff. They kept saying that it had commercially confidential information in it, but, you know, finding out that your drug isn't so great, I can understand that might have commercial implications, but it's not really...
But it should.
It's not really commercially confidential, exactly. They were saying that it had individual patient data in it, and that's kind of true in the full clinical study report, but they're in separate appendices, and the administrative burden is like, you know, the ring binder, and you have to click the things, and you lift the thing over, and then you get to the right tongue, and you take that out, and you put it on the table, and then you put the things back, and you... close the thing. And
wait, this is not electronic? These are actual binders. Okay.
Actually, depending on how far back you go, there's a story I can't tell you about paper archives for about 2 weeks, but it will make you...
We'll get you later on drinks.
Yeah, yeah. you know, they made all of these claims, which the European Ombudsman said were just absurd. And eventually, after 3.5 years, the European Ombudsman said, you know, you are in breach of the Declaration of Helsinki, which is the moral code that came out of the trials at Nuremberg that covers all trials research. And they just said, look, you know, everybody involved in research has an obligation to make research findings public. You're exposing patients to harm by withholding this information. Your brief public summaries are incomplete and inaccurate. It's a truly extraordinary ruling. And what's the purpose of telling that story is since 2010, since this damning finding of maladministration by the European Ombudsman, the European Medicines Agency has been forced to share the clinical study reports that they hold. So this isn't all of the clinical study reports on all of the trials for all of the medicines that we currently use. It's a tiny, tiny subset. They only have them going back a couple of years. They don't even have all the modules for all of the ones that they do have. But they are now releasing this stuff, and they expect to be awarded some kind of certificate for awesomeness and transparency. It's just extraordinary because it only came about because of the most damning finding of maladministration that people who work in Europe say they've ever seen. And so it's episodes like that that I think are very disappointing. And, you know, we can talk about the revolving door between regulators and industry and regulatory capture and all of that stuff. I'm not sure I care about the people stories. I care about what they do, you know. And we should be entitled to expect that regulators have patients' best interests at heart. And the way that they behave has historically not been very reassuring on that front. Maybe it really will change. The EMA are making big promises. We will see.
Well, so not surprisingly, you've ruffled a few feathers with this approach. And let me bring up a couple of quotes from one of the people you ruffled.
Chat.
Yeah. So one of the people you apparently upset is Stephen Whitehead, who is the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry CEO. And you wrote an open letter to you, and I'm just going to read a couple of things just to give people an idea of what it is, and then you can comment about it.
He wrote an open letter to me.
Well, this was published. Yeah. No, okay. This was published. You did see it. You responded to it.
Oh.
So, at least I hope you saw
it. This is like a letter that he posted.
This was published in the New Statement.
Oh, that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly that one. So just to give our audience a sort of a taste of what's going on here. Whited said that you are seem to be stuck in a bygone era where pharmaceutical companies wine and dine doctors in exchange for signing on the dotted line. The pharmaceutical industry has been responsible for the development of 90% of medicines in the world, and through incremental innovation has helped the management of many illnesses. We'll need to go back to that in a minute. And then the industry does not seek trial data. To hide trial data, it is already best practice within the industry to publish all data, positive and negative. You don't buy any of that, do you?
Well, okay. So, I mean, Stephen Whitehead has behaved truly astonishingly over this book. I'm not sure I fully identify as a skeptic in the sense that I don't really care about God. I'm not an atheist. I'm an apatheist. I just find it really boring either way. But I'm lucky not to live in a country that has lots of reactionary Christians in it. I'm not very interested in psychics or ghosts. Quackery is sort of funny to me and a useful tool for explaining the basics of evidence-based medicine. But in talking to people who write about quackery, it seems to me that the reason why they don't write about problems in evidence in mainstream medicine is partly they feel a bit intimidated by the complexity, although it is basically the same thing, but just slightly more sophisticated bad behavior with the evidence. But also, I think the reason why people write more about out-and-out quacks is that they behave so badly when you criticize them that they just create fun narratives, right? They will say that black is white and night is day. They will issue lurid conspiratorial denunciations. They'll threaten to sue a 12-year-old blogger. You know, they'll send... What's his name? Who was it? Oh, it was Rees Morgan in England. You know, they sent a school kid pictures of his house. I mean, you know, quacks will behave appallingly badly. But actually, what I have discovered to my true amazement is that the pharmaceutical industry, $700 billion global industry, will actually behave in a very, very similar fashion. So when the book came out, mm-hmm. they put out a press release saying that all of the issues in this book are historic and they have all been fixed. And that's an extraordinary thing to say about a book, which, like a lot of it, especially like the badly designed trials bit, that's basic undergraduate medical degree stuff, right? Like I teach that to medical students. Trials are very frequently flawed by design. There's nothing weird or conspiracy theorist about that. That's like, you can't get a medical degree without understanding that stuff. Like anybody who believed Stephen Whitehead would fail to qualify as a doctor. And the problem of missing clinical
trials... Maybe we should be worried then.
Well, yeah. The problem of missing clinical trial data, which Stephen Whitehead says is all historic and has long been addressed and it's best practice. Well, you know, the best currently available evidence from a systematic review shows that half of all trials for the medicines that we use today have not been published, that positive results are about twice as likely to be published as negative ones. And not just that, but I mean, that would be bad enough because that's the evidence base for what we have today. But everything that people claim has fixed that problem hasn't just failed, it's actually delivered false reassurance and perpetuated the problem. So, for example, everybody said that the clinicaltrials.gov legislation had fixed this problem forever. So the FDA Amendment Act 2007, I mean, you could be out sort of smoking crack and injecting heroin and hanging out with models in New York, but you're listening to me talk about the FDA Amendment Act 2007. This reflects very badly on you. So the FDA Amendment Act 2007 said all trials conducted and completed with at least one site in the US or for a marketing authorization have to post their results on clinicaltrials.gov within 1 year of completion. And everybody said, oh, fantastic, this has been fixed forever. No public audit. When a public audit was finally conducted and published in one of the top five medical journals in the world in 2012, it found that the rate of compliance with this law, which everybody said had fixed the problem, was 22%. Four trials out of five have failed to comply with this legislation.
I would naively say that that's low.
Well, yeah, I'd say that's pretty poor. And actually, right, even if it had worked perfectly, it still would have failed to fix the problem because it only required you to post the results of trials that were conducted and completed after October 2008. Now, out of all the prescriptions issued over the past year, 80 to 85% of them are for medicines that came on the market more than 10 years ago, generic medications.
Right.
Now, we don't need the results of clinical trials from 2008. We need the trial results from 2003, 2001, 1998, 1993. And this stuff's all out there. You know, it's in dry document storage archives in the chalk hills of Cheshire and decommissioned nuclear bunkers in the Arizona desert or whatever. And we just need that stuff. You know, getting us all of the trials that are conducted and completed after October 2008, that would help improve the evidence base for medicine in about 2033. But I'm feeling quite impatient about this problem right now. I want to make sure I have the evidence base to make informed decisions about my patients now, today, in 2013. So the notion that this problem has been fixed is utterly fallacious. And I wouldn't want to make any comment about the motives of any individual, because you have to be careful what you say about this, right? But
you could be sued.
But I will say, as a general point about the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, there's a famous quote from the tobacco lobby, right? The leaked memo, doubt is our product. All we have to do is spread a little bit of doubt in people's minds, because people don't want to believe that tobacco causes cancer. We just, doubt is our product. We just sow a little bit of doubt, right? For industry, there is nothing more important than maintaining their ability to withhold unflattering data about the results of clinical trials. The marketing stuff, they can take it or leave it. The paid advocates, gifts, trips, any of that stuff, they can live without. What matters to them more than anything else is to continue being able to withhold evidence about the effectiveness of treatment, and they will defend that viciously to the very end. And delay is their product. And their main objective is to firstly persuade people that this problem doesn't exist, because it's so obviously preposterous, right? As soon as you're given a clean, clear explanation, as soon as you're told half of all clinical trials for the treatments we use today haven't been published and positive results are twice as likely to be published, everybody just goes, well, that's obviously absurd, right? What do you mean evidence-based medicine? How can you possibly be serious?
Selective evidence-based medicine.
Well, quite, yes. You know, I genuinely believe future generations will look back on the way that we've tolerated this in absolute amazement. I mean, they'll look back in the way that we look back at medieval blood letters, right? They'll say, you spent tens of millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, on one clinical trial sometimes, and you obsessed over making it sure that it was as free as possible from bias. You used all of these sophisticated statistical tools to try and detect very, very modest differences sometimes between one treatment group and another. And you went to all of this huge effort to produce this perfect evidence. And then after that, at the final furlong, you just let half of it get erased from history. And not even any old half, but you let half of it get the less flattering half be selectively erased. I mean, it's so ridiculous.
Or shredded in one case, right?
Well, or shredded in another future story that I will tell you in about 3 weeks' time, right?
So, but this brings
anyway,
up...
Sorry,
go ahead. So,
I was just going to say, delay is their product, right?
Yeah.
Every single thing, like everything that you see from industry is about delaying us fixing this problem. And they will fight on that harder than they will fight on anything else. They will do everything they possibly can to continue the current system where they are able to hide unflattering data.
Right.
And
so
nothing matters more to them.
You've used tonight several times the term evidence or evidence-based. Now, one of our friends, Steve Novella, who does the among other things, the Skeptic Guide to the Universe podcast, makes a big deal of making a distinction between evidence-based medicine and science-based medicine, when in this case, the idea is that sort of science is a little higher standard than evidence. The problem being that evidence, it's a little generic. You know, anecdotal evidence is still evidence, unreliable, but it is evidence. Selective evidence is still evidence. You can cite it and all that sort of stuff, but clearly wouldn't pass, as you were pointing out a minute ago, or shouldn't pass muster even with an undergraduate student in training in medical research. So there is this distinction. Now, today we do hear a lot, however, about evidence-based this or evidence-based that. I guess one of the problems we're getting at here is that evidence is not a panacea. It's not like, oh, well, I got evidence for it, therefore you should believe me. It really does, it's a question of the quality of the evidence. in this case, even the quality of the evidence that is being withdrawn from the public. But generally speaking, I mean, you can do a sloppy study just because it is, in fact, a sloppily done period without actually any intention of hiding anything. There's been some interesting meta studies of a lot of medical research that have appeared over the last several years that have shown exactly that often the problem is simply with suboptimal experimental design, even when it's done by non-pharmaceutical researchers mm-hmm. that are not actually funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Now, one of the things you do point out is that when the researchers are funded by the pharmaceutical industry, somehow the positive results all of a sudden increase significantly, right? Is that's you're not implying that there is necessarily a conscious bias there or but on the part of the researchers?
Well, there's certainly a conscious bias. I mean, industry wants to get positive results and you know, that will drive behavior. I don't know what I would call it, whether I'd say there's evidence-based medicine and science-based medicine, but the reality is there are, you know, there's good evidence and there's bad evidence. And, you know, you've got to make sure that you don't allow people to cherry pick data to use badly designed trials. But actually, I mean, we fall down on some really basic stuff. For example, you know, regulators often have this idea that it's okay for them to make decisions behind closed doors. And actually Roche have now started saying, the one thing I'm sort of reasonably pleased with is by moving this discussion ahead in the UK, at least, where the book came out a couple of months ago, there's now a parliamentary select committee inquiry into missing clinical trial data. There have been questions in parliament, a little bit of TV and radio stuff here and there. And so we started flushing out people from industry and also elsewhere who will try to defend withholding data. And one thing that a lot of them say is, look, you know, regulators should make these decisions behind closed doors about what works and what doesn't. And that is a really, really interesting betrayal of the scientific method and failure to recognize how evidence and science should work. Because you're not trusted in science because you wear a white coat or you've got lots of letters after your name.
Or
you shouldn't be. You know, science, in as far as it has any authority, that derives from transparency. It's about showing your methods and results, sharing your working. The Royal Society in London has its motto, like a soap TV show or like a sitcom, has its motto like chipped in stone, and it's nullius in verba, on the word of no one, show me your working. Now, regulators like to make decisions behind closed doors. And that suits a lot of people. The problem is, sometimes regulators make the wrong call. If you look at some of the big problems in medicine, Vioxx, for example, wasn't spotted by regulators. Problems there were spotted by independent academics and doctors. Problems with rosiglitazone, Avandia, not spotted by regulators, spotted by independent doctors and academics. Similarly, problems with the evidence base for Tamiflu, not spotted by regulators, spotted by independent academics and researchers. And that's not because regulators are stupid people. They're not. It's because these are very difficult problems. And like all difficult problems, they benefit from many eyes. And withholding information about how trials were conducted and what their results were, and the full clinical study reports and all of the detailed information, by withholding that from doctors and academics, you're just restricting the number of people who can see it and the number of people who can spot problems. And it's okay for people to have discussion and debate. But actually, you know, I can tell you of regulators that I've spoken to who say, look, if this stuff was freely available, there'd be panic in the streets. And you go, right, what do you mean? What exactly are you withholding? And actually, I don't think they mean because people will find out the horrors that we've hidden. Hopefully not, although in some cases here and there, you know. But what they mean is there will be public disagreement. And that's completely normal and fine. I mean, what could be more normal in science than people publicly disagreeing? And it's just such a strange corner of the world. It's very paternalistic, actually. It's a lot like, you know, doctors in the 50s, maybe even the 70s, maybe even now, if you're unlucky, you know, we would routinely lie to our patients. We'd say, oh, shut up. I'm not even going to tell you the diagnosis. Shut up and take the pills, right? And
makes your work easier.
Well, quite. And doctors these days, I'm not sure it does, actually, but doctors these days don't do that, hopefully. I mean, we teach our medical students to work together with the patient towards an optimum health outcome, according to the communication skills handout. And that's real, that's important stuff, you know.
But to be fair,
regulators are treating doctors like doctors used to treat patients. It's shut up, we know best. And that's preposterous.
Yeah, that is a bad idea, it seems to me. But to be fair, a little bit on the other side of the same argument that you're making is in terms of, you know, access of the public, by the public, to this kind of information in terms of transparency. Well, we have had, and we still have, a lot of controversies. In the United States, the most famous one is probably the one about vaccines and autism, where, you know, published studies are available to the public, and the public makes a mess out of it. Because, by and large, the public tends to be uninformed about science, unsophisticated about how to interpret science, has a nasty tendency to follow celebrities who have a nasty tendency to talk about things they don't understand. So, I mean, I can see the point of saying, well...
Yeah, and they all cite MMR. They all cite vaccines. But all of those scare stories happened. They happened... Anyway, it's my hunch that there is like a fixed volume of stupid news stories about health, and that fixed volume will be filled with whatever people can find to fill it.
So actually, if I just write like 2,000 articles about the negative effects of some random plant somewhere, then we're done for the year, and we can just have good science for the rest of the year.
If we could deliver our bolus in the first week of the year, that would be ideal. And also, you know, secrecy actively ferments conspiracy theories. And once things are open, people get bored. In the UK, there's something called the COINS database, which was opened up to the public last year. Tory government have actually been very good about opening up government data. And the COINS database is every receipt in the whole of government over £6 or something, $9. And the first week that the COINS database was published, obviously the newspapers were absolutely stuffed full of it, and really vicious stuff, like, you know, is this the most wasteful civil servant in Britain? We found the admin secretary who spent more in florists than anyone else. Yeah, really nasty, silly stuff. And then once that week was over, there has not been a single COINS database story ever since. It's just boring. It's
people
just a load
bored.
Of receipts. God, who wants to go through a load of receipts? They're really boring. And it's the same with clinical study reports. There's no more opportunity to create mischief in CSRs than there is in straight, like, briefer summaries of clinical trials in academic journals. It's an excuse. And what's really disturbing is to see the lines put out by industry being parroted by people in regulators and by people in government. And that's scary. You know, Poulter, junior health minister in the UK, recently said to the Bill Committee on the Health Research Authority, seriously, you should be hanging out with like models in a punk basement club somewhere. Anyway, the Bill Committee for the Health Research Authority.
I love your conception of our outside options tonight.
Yeah. We should say that those options, of course, are available only for people who are actually physically here, not the people who are going to be listening.
Seriously,
to
you can't see this at home, but almost everyone here is naked. They're covered in tattoos, you know, piercings through parts of the body I don't even know the name of. But they're all really captivated by my description of what happened with the junior health minister at the Bill Committee for the new Health Research Authority
for
in the UK.
For some reason, yeah.
It's bizarre, isn't it? It's true what they say about science being the new rock and roll. So Health Research Authority, really awesome. The person who's in charge of it, Janet Wisely, really muscular, strong possibilities here, right? She's saying maybe ethics committees should actually start saying to people, you've got to publish the results of trials that you do, and you've also perhaps even got to prove that you're not withholding the results of any previous clinical trials before you're allowed to touch any more patients, which I think is actually very sensible, because it's actually more than anything, I'd say, I mean, apart from the fact that you're distorting evidence and therefore harming patients by withholding data, as if that wasn't bad enough, it's also a betrayal of the participants in the trials, because people participate in clinical trials as patients in the belief that what they're doing is going to generate new knowledge that will improve the treatment of other people in a similar predicament to them in the future. And when patients find out that half of all trials don't get published, they are quite correctly really angry and annoyed. Actually, we've got a bunch of patients in our campaign group, alltrials.net, who've been writing to people saying, can you fix this? We're trial participants. We're annoyed about this. And industry have had the gall to say, well, if you say this to patients, then people will be less reluctant to participate in trials. Well, it's very sad. You're going to stop people participating in trials. You go, right, you want me to maintain your lie to avoid frightening people. Why don't we just fix the problem? It's utterly bizarre behavior. But anyway, Janet Wisely, Health Research Authority, yes, going to be muscular in the Bill Committee that sets up this authority. They're talking about putting that in legislation. And Poulter, the health minister, also a doctor, said, well, we've got to be very careful. People might, you know, pharmaceutical companies might leave if we do this.
You just think,
my God, I mean, what an amazingly candid, low opinion you have of drug companies that you will very openly say they want to hide data and mislead doctors and consequently harm patients. What an extraordinary...
And we better let them do that, otherwise they leave and do it somewhere else.
Exactly. So we went and met the other health minister with responsibility for the pharmaceutical industry, Earl Howe. Everybody in England is an earl or a lord, by the way. I don't know if
you picked up on that. Yeah, I noticed, yeah.
And, you know, he said, oh, we've got to be very careful because, you know, they're already angry about the fact that we're not paying them very much for medicines through the NHS because the NHS sets prices and we've been keeping prices very low, blah, blah, blah. And,
yeah, you socialists, you know.
Exactly, in the socialist utopia of the National Health Service, yeah. And the day before, the head of the ABPI, Stephen Whitehead, the man who says that none of these problems exist, I mean... How that man still has his job is a mystery to me. He can't even competently deny things or smear. Do you know what I mean? That's what I find insulting. Anyway, the day before, he'd given a talk where he'd said, you know, if government doesn't pay us enough for these pills, we're going to take jobs away. I mean, it's possible that people take jobs away. And people in government were complaining about this as if it was somehow unjust or unreasonable or unfair or weird. And actually, I completely disagree. This is the normal bread and butter of medicine. Give us a regional development grant to put a car factory in Detroit and some tax breaks, yep. Or we'll take jobs away. This is normal. This is bread and butter. This is completely
normal. Blackmail.
Give us money,
yep.
And we'll give you some jobs. That's what happens, right? But what should never be on the table is allow us to withhold clinical trial results, mislead doctors and harm patients, or we will take our jobs away, right? That shouldn't be part of the transaction.
That would be like saying, in the case of the car industry, you give us the money or we will make cars that actually are going to break down and kill people.
Allow us to put like lots and lots of little flaws in the seat belts or we will take jobs away.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, for that matter, I mean, talking about the incentives that the pharmaceuticals respond to, You made the striking point in the book that the penalties that they actually when they actually are taken to task for obstructing evidence or for like withholding evidence that showed that their product was dangerous, they're when they are penalized, it's nothing compared to the revenue that they get from their drugs. That it's like, I think you said, a parking ticket. Why can't government set penalties higher so that pharmaceuticals actually have an incentive not to put out drugs that harm tens of thousands of people?
Does too big to fail ring a bell?
Well, when you say harm, I mean, we have to be absolutely clear. I think it's fairly unusual that drugs come on the market which do more harm than good. It happens, but I think it's reasonably unusual. The harm that comes is mainly because people are deprived of the best currently available treatment because we're misled about the relative benefits. So I know we covered that earlier with the 6 and the 8 people being crushed under the diesel locomotive. But yeah, you're right. The penalties are trivial. I mean, GSK, who we perhaps have to be a little nicer about because they've just signed up to alltrials.net, and we should talk about that in a moment. GSK fined $3 billion for acts of criminal and civil fraud relating to mis-selling of medicines and withholding clinical trial data just last year. $3 billion, but the sum total of revenue just for the drugs covered, just for the period covered by the acts of criminal and civil fraud, was $27 billion. So it was like 10% of revenue during that period. The fines for non-compliance with clinicaltrials.gov, that law that fixed everything, according to people like Stephen Whitehead, but which has actually been ignored by 4 trials out of 5, that law, even if penalties had been enforced, and the FDA has never, ever fined anyone for non-compliance with this law, even if that fine had been enforced, it's $10,000 a day. Now, I hope that would be a struggle for any of you to pay. Otherwise, I feel like my life has gone horribly wrong. But $3.5 million a year to a company that's making billions of dollars a year, or to a big research organization, it's a parking ticket. It's utterly trivial. I've shaken the hands of individuals who earn more than $3.5 million a year. There aren't very many of them around, but I have touched them, so they exist, you know. So the penalties are utterly, utterly trivial. But, you know, more than anything else, I find it weird that people get preoccupied with the idea of, we have to find ways of forcing people to hand this stuff over. Because actually, we haven't really tried asking. That is the extraordinary extent of the failure of ambition and vision on the part of my own profession and regulators. The clinical trials registers that exist are these kind of small, unsatisfactory, ad hoc, non-overlapping or partially overlapping lists. Clinicaltrials.gov is a list of some of the trials that have been conducted in America, quite a lot of them since 2007. But none of the trials conducted elsewhere, or very, very few of them. The European Clinical Trials Register is all the trials conducted in Europe for the past few years. But that's not a useful list of trials. We need a list of all the trials that have been conducted on all of the medicines that are currently in use. And this is a very easy thing to ask for. I mean, it should be very straightforward. Dear X, congratulations, your medicine is currently available for prescription in the European Union. As you know, we have the European Clinical Trials Register. This is a list of all the trials that have ever been done on any use of any medicine that is currently available for prescription in the European Union. Here are the forms. Just let us know. Fill them out. And we'll just pop them all up on the European Clinical Trials Register. No one's ever done that.
When you put it like that, it sounds easy. But
well, no, but we could try ask, do you know what I mean? In a systematic and comprehensive way. And if people started playing silly buggers then, well, then we could start to think about it. But we actually haven't tried. You know, people talk about evidence-based medicine. And I'm a huge believer. I mean, biggest advocate you could come across for this, right? But where's the list of trials? Like, we cannot even produce a list of all of the evidence that we use in medicine. We don't have a list of all the trials that have ever been done. I find that completely bizarre. But it's sort of ad hoc.
Again, however, that doesn't, if you think about it in the sort of the broader picture of, you know, just not just medical research, but science generally, that's not really that unusual or surprising, right? I mean, it should be worrisome, but the file drawer effect, the idea that, you know, I've been done work in evolutionary biology and ecology, and I can tell you that a lot of the papers that get published are probably, you know, 10% or 20% of the stuff that actually gets done. Most of the stuff is never published. It languishes in sort of some people's literally drawers, now hard drives and things like that. And of course, as a result, you do get these very skewed perspective on a number of issues. Now, of course, when it comes to the, you know, ecology of a local plant species nobody's heard of, well, who cares? When it comes to your health, that's a little more worrisome.
Exactly. You know, this is a problem that affects everything. If you look at the functional brain imaging literature, there are more positive findings than the number of observations should support, which strongly suggests that people are data-rich.
It's a problem, yeah.
If you look at, there was a fantastic paper in March 2012 in Nature where they just said, okay, 53 basic molecular biology papers that are suggestive of a potential target for cancer treatment. Let's see how many we can replicate. And the answer was 6 out of 53. And they reckoned that the reason why they weren't able to replicate this stuff was that people were publishing flukes. And their recommendation was we should be better at providing vehicles for people to publish negative findings. Now, that's just a microcosm.
But those are not sexy.
Well, they're not sexy maybe in molecular biology, but they're vitally important in clinical medicine. And it's extraordinary to see. I mean, there are people like John Lamatina, the previous head of R&D at Pfizer, who's now writing sort of trying to say, oh, well, when a trial has a negative result, that's not really important because it's a failed trial. It's not a failed trial. It's a really useful piece of information showing that a drug didn't work.
Sure.
Now, if there's a design flaw, you know about that before you do your trial. Right. You don't find out that there's a design flaw at the end when it doesn't give you the answer that you want.
Absolutely. But if we're talking about the numbers we're talking, I can imagine as an academic, you know, going up for tenure and say, here, I got 20 publications. 17 of them showed that absolutely nothing happened or nothing interesting happened. But here, I got them published anyway because they're negative results. And yeah, you know, your dean is going
to
look at it.
We need to find microcredits and ways of rewarding it. I mean, remember, what you're talking about is only an issue in basic science. In clinical trials, there are no barriers to publishing negative results. In fact, even when people are obliged to under the law, just by posting a brief summary on clinicaltrials.gov, they fail to do so 4 times out of 5. You're right. In basic science research, it's a problem.
But that was another thing I was surprised by that you mentioned in the book, that journals actually are not as resistant to publishing, at least medical journals, not as resistant to publishing negative results as I thought they were, or even as the researchers themselves thought the journals would be. So I wonder if just better dissemination of information would make researchers more willing to submit their articles that had negative results in them for publication.
So the best currently available evidence from the systematic review from 2010 shows that journal discrimination against negative results is not the bottleneck in publishing. Now, right. Actually, I don't have a hugely high opinion of academic journals. They publish utter dross. And they also let people get away with all kinds of analytic crimes. They let people switch the primary outcome in their trial. They let them deal in stupid ways with missing data. They let them get away without doing intention to treat analyses and so on. So there are huge problems with journals. They also have massive conflicts of interest around accepting studies with positive results and studies that are industry sponsored. But I just don't think it's, I don't think it's realistic any longer to say that that trialists feel that there's no sort of outlet for their creative work.
So that, that's one
trialists?
Problem that's been
people
solved.
People who run clinical trials.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So that's one problem that you think it's been
that's
pretty
right,
much
but,
solved.
But also, I mean, you know, the real problem that hasn't been fixed is that we haven't invested enough in the sort of supporting stroma of scientific evidence. We spend tens and hundreds of millions of dollars on just one trial, but we haven't invested in the kind of the basic information architecture of evidence-based medicine. We don't even have a list of all the trials that have been done, matching protocols against publications and spotting the differences and the gaps. Now, you know, if you put me in charge of NIH for a year, and let me reassure you, this is reasonably unlikely to happen anytime soon, you know, I would cancel all trials research for a year. We can live without another trial comparing ovarian cancer, two treatments head-to-head, just for 1 year. And I'm sorry if that disturbs or alarms you, but just for 1 year, I would spend every single penny that we have on better systems for collating the evidence that we already have, systematically putting it all together, summarizing it, disseminating it to decision makers, doctors, patients, healthcare providers. And I would and I'd invest in monitoring the outcomes and appraising the benefits and finding the best systems for doing that. And at the moment, this is regarded as a sort of cheap second cousin. It's these are sort of they're cottage projects. You know, every now and then you see a pharmacist in a district general hospital does a project on whether doing a notes review stops patients on an old age ward having more than five drugs at the same time. But you know, we need to invest massively in making sure that we properly understand and use the evidence that we already have. And it's a classic problem in medicine and in science generally. If your project requires a lot of money and it's sort of glamorous and involves machines that go ping, you sort of accrue, there's a halo effect of power. Sure. You see it in psychology departments. You know, the people who do functional brain imaging experiments, well, that requires machines that cost millions of dollars and staff to run them and engineers and stuff like that. And they kind of accumulate a glamour. And the psychophysicists who just do pen and paper and stopwatch stuff on verbal fluency, they're still getting Nature papers, but all they cost is their salary and maybe some notebooks, right? And they don't have that same kind of glamour. And that's the problem with the world of clinical trials research. You know, trials are big admin-heavy projects. They require a lot of manpower. They bring in grant money. They've got overheads. And people accrue power around that. But actually, the projects of evidence synthesis just don't have the same oomph and prominence. But it's the bit that we've neglected. It's the bit that we've failed on.
The prestige of the machine that got beep is definitely across the science again. First of all, about the fMRI scans, one of the things that always I find always curious is that there's no way you can, almost no way you can fail that kind of research, because you know what, you're going to show that while you're thinking about something, some part of your brain is active.
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, you know, I used to do functional brain imaging research, and I've seen some extraordinary things. I mean, SPM, which is the analytic software that people use, there are so many opportunities to have a second go. You know, you can go, oh, well, nothing lit up right. Well, maybe we should rerun the alignment, because I think their head moved. Maybe if we put in some different alignment parameters. And also, we have to convert, everybody's brain's a bit different anatomically, but we normalize them all to the Tallarak and Turnow atlas. Maybe we should renormalize the brains. Maybe that'll make things light up nicely. And that's one of the many ways in which you manage to get more positive findings out of the functional brain imaging literature than the data you've collected should allow. So you understand the basic idea that out of so many experiments with a statistical cutoff of whatever, you should only be able to find a certain number of findings. Of positive signals. And if you're finding a weirdly large number of positive findings, then either the entire field is full of really lucky people, or something's gone wrong.
Yes, more likely than the latter. Yeah, I remember years ago in the National Science Foundation asking a bunch of ecologists, including myself, about this this issue that, you know, ecology is a low-tech discipline, and, you know, we really need to, in order to go to Congress and get some money, we really need to get some, you know, big science. Like, so, you know, they were talking about...
we need to invent some expensive machines.
Yeah, exactly. So we were talking about, you know, the equivalent...
Like a tennis ball thrower.
The equivalent of a telescope or a space probe or something like that. So they brought a bunch of us into a room for an entire weekend asking us, so,
to invent a completely superfluous, expensive machine.
Yeah, it's pretty much. And so they kept telling us, so if I gave you $100 million, what would you do with them? And the best that most of my colleagues, including myself, could come up with is, well, I could hire 1,000 postdocs and do a lot of field work. So like, no, that's wrong. We want one big piece of equipment. And of course, you know, at some point people got creative and said, well, I could do my research in the rainforest with helicopters. Would that help?
Gold-plated helicopters. Got to spend that money.
You know, right. I mean, there have probably been about maybe 300,000 trials ever done. Give me £1 million, maybe a little bit more. Give me £2 million, and I will give
What's
you.
What's the change exchange rate between the quid and the dollar?
Give me $2 or $3 million, and I will give you a list of all of the trial registries, all linked and matched up, and all of the publications, and I will give you a list of which drugs are the worst for. Missing trial data, which companies are the worst for missing trial data, which companies are the worst for missing trial data, which countries are the worst for missing trial data, which disease areas are the worst for missing trial data. I'll be able to tell patient groups, hey, you know, you get very upset when people mention that you take money off industry and you want to protest that you're independent. Well, here's your opportunity. Of the drugs taken by your members, here's a list. Here's a list of all the trials that are missing. Here are the data controllers for those trials. You should be writing, you know, the National Rheumatoid Arthritis Society should be writing to the companies that make the drugs that their members take and saying, we can see from alltrials.org's list that the following four trials for treatments that are taken by our members have not been published. This is 700 patients worth of data. Please, can you tell us where it is and why you haven't published it? Get £2 or $3 million, $2 or $3 million, whatever it is that you...
So we can talk there one-to-one.
Ben, before we have to wrap up, would it be possible for you to leave our audience and our listeners with some with some practical advice for how to evaluate medical questions in the meantime before we reach the happy stage of, actually science-based medicine and, you know, true transparency and so on. Like, yeah, are there some...
Before 2030, whatever it was that you mentioned.
Well, so I'm thinking of something like, is there a particularly reliable source of these systematic reviews on particular issues? Are there some subfields of medicine or kinds of drugs that you can trust the evidence on more? Like, I got the sense from your book, although you didn't address this question explicitly, that drugs for depression were, like the studies about drugs for depression were, you know, less reliable on average than studies for other kinds of drugs, although I could be wrong about that. Correct me if need be.
So I'm really militant on this. I don't do like top five checklists, and I don't do readers' health advice, and I don't say which things are good and which things are bad. I'm obsessed and sanctimonious about this. I don't think that you can solve any of these problems by identifying like a good drug or a good corner of the evidence sphere. These are systemic failures, and the only way to fix it is by fixing the system's failures. So the thing that, if anybody wanted to help, after the book came out, we realized that there was a sort of head of steam growing in the UK. So we set up alltrials.net, which was me and some friends. I say friends, I mean the British Medical Journal and the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford University and Sense About Science, who are fun and awesome. And alltrials.net is campaigning for... just to know about the existence of all the trials that have ever been conducted and completed, for brief summary results and full clinical study reports, minus identifiable patient data where it's available. And that's supported now by 85 patient groups, the great and the good of independent academic research funding in the UK, ICWIC, the German cost effectiveness agency, who did the Reboxetine story that I mentioned earlier. Also GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, amazingly. And if you've got, if you're a member of any kind of professional body, whether it's a Royal College or the AMA, it's a rather conservative organization from what I understand, or any patient group or anyone, you know, get them to sign up. Like nothing can work in medicine until we have all of the clinical trials. Like everything that we do, everything we pretend to be doing is completely broken when half the data is missing. And fixing that has to come before everything else. And that's where the most fun will be, right? You know, industry will fight viciously on this. They'll roll over and they'll make concessions on things like money for doctors and marketing and all of that stuff. But if you try and stop them hiding data, they will fight vindictively and viciously. And that's how you know how much it matters to them. And that's fixing that's the most important thing.
And after this, I challenge anybody here to go to the pharmacy tonight.
Well, no, I mean, that's the real difficulty, isn't it? You know, it's still the only game in town. And my judgment, and it is only a judgment, my judgment from looking at a lot of these stories is that overall, it's quite rare that there are treatments that actively do more harm than good, and that we're mostly misled around what's the best treatment out of what's available.
Okay, I'll take that as an optimistic ending note. That's the best I'm probably going to get. So, but I do encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Bad Pharma, because Ben has, in addition to the stuff that made me want to punch the book, there's several inspiring lists of things that you can do to start improving the situation. So pick up a copy of Bad Pharma, maybe a paper copy, not an ebook, in case you feel like punching something that's not your computer. And we are now out of time. So Ben, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest on Rationally Speaking.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Sorry to be so depressing.
This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that if you're a fan of the Rationally Speaking podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this year's Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which will be held in New York, New York, the weekend of April 5th through 7th, 2013. Go to nexus.org now to get your tickets. They're on sale. In addition to Massimo and I, you'll also find a lineup of great speakers, including the SGU, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, and our keynote speaker, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Drunkard's Walk. Nexus.org, that's NECSS.org. Go get your tickets now.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.